This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Most of us look forward to mealtime. It's one of the most pleasurable times of our day, so much so, in fact, that we have devoted monthly hours to food and to cooking on this program. And WFAE has even started a food blog, WFAE Eats. But for some, food is more than nourishment and pleasure. It is a compulsion, an addiction. And for those suffering from food addictions, eating becomes a curse. And evidently, increasing numbers of people are suffering from food addiction or compulsion, given the rising incidence of obesity in the country. So this hour, we're taking a closer look at all of this. We're joined by Dr. Valerie Taylor, MD, a psychiatrist in the Mood Disorders Program and director of the Bariatric Psychiatry Program at St. Joseph's Healthcare in Hamilton, Ontario, where she joins us this morning. Welcome to the program, Doctor.
Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. And with us in our Spirit Square studio is Ellen Carey, a clinical dietitian at the Center for Disordered Eating at Levine Children's Hospital. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
And we're also joined by a woman we'll call Rebecca. She is a recovering food addict and a member of Food Addicts in Recovery Anonymous. Welcome.
Good morning.
Nice to have you with us. Dr. Taylor, you're also a professor in psychiatry and behavioral neurosciences at McMaster University up there in Ontario, where you focus on obesity and metabolic syndrome and mental health. How widespread is the incidence of food addiction or food compulsion?
I think it's, in terms of accurate numbers, very difficult to define because it's not really accepted by mainstream yet. We just know that, you know, if you think about conditions like binge eating disorder, which is a recognized psychiatric diagnosis where people overeat, can't control the amount they're eating, and go on food binges, that affects about 3% of the general population, but it affects about 35% of people who show up looking for treatment of eating problems. And so if you look at the fact that millions and millions of people are struggling with their weight in the U.S. and in Canada, and if you think about 35% of that population shows up because they feel they have some sort of underlying pathology that's driving them to eat, now, we're talking about huge numbers, even if only half of that 35% would qualify as having a food addiction. We're still talking about, you know, hundreds and thousands of people.
And where you work, Ellen, you're the Center for Disordered Eating. We were talking just before the program started that the people that you work with, adolescents and teens, prefer to think of themselves as having a disordered eating problem as opposed to an eating disorder. It's semantics, I suppose, but what's the difference?
Well, I think that having an eating disorder is more of a medical diagnosis, having more medical consequences that a lot of times adolescents and their families don't want to necessarily admit at first. And so having more of a disordered eating is more a behavioral patterns that they know that they can admit mm-hmm. that are a problem.
Now, I'm old. So I noticed that there are more overweight people among us today than there were in the 60s, in the 70s. And I don't recall anybody ever talking about eating disorders or eating compulsions or food addiction until 5 years ago, maybe 6 years ago. Is that because we didn't have a name for it? Is that because it didn't exist? Is that because it's just now coming out of the closet and we didn't used to talk about things like that, just like we didn't used to talk about cancer?
Right. I think it's a combination of all of those things. I mean, I think that we live in a very weight-focused society, and, you know, weight and food are always on people's minds. And so I think that it is definitely more prevalent, but people are talking about it a lot more.
Are weight and food, Doctor, on people's minds because they're on television all the time? You'll see a commercial for a fast food restaurant, and then you'll see a commercial for Jenny Craig. I mean, is that what's going on here in part?
Well, we are being inundated by images of, exactly as you say, ways to increase our caloric consumption and ways to lose weight, often by very unhealthy and unrealistic weight loss plans. But if you also, you know, when we keep coming back to the term addiction, if you go back to, you know, the 60s and even the 70s, no one talked about tobacco addiction. It just wasn't something that you were allowed to say. You couldn't get addicted to smoking cigarettes. And the companies that made cigarettes came out with all these articles, and all the experts who said it was impossible to become addicted to cigarettes, and cigarettes weren't related to health problems. And we're now sort of come full circle, and we're seeing the exact same phenomenon with food. And so right now people are saying, no, I have a problem. There's something going on. I think there's something in the environment that's impacting my behavior, and I'm having some problems. And people are saying it's impossible to be addicted to food. And all of the food companies are saying, that can't happen. There's absolutely no evidence to say that there's a link between, you know, food and addictive behavior. And so it's very ironic. We've been here before. It's just the players are different. And 15 years from now, just like today, if somebody said you can't be addicted to cigarettes, we'd all go, no, that's ludicrous. Of course you can. We know that. You know, in 15 years, we're going to be saying the same thing about food, and hopefully we'll have found ways to perhaps have better treatment.
And we'll take a look at some of the foods that may be leading to these addictions or may be easy to become addicted to. Is there a difference between food addiction, the term food addiction, and food compulsion or disordered eating? Are those three distinctly different things?
I think that compulsive overeating is a type of eating disorder.
Okay.
You know, the same with being addicted to food, I guess, is a way of saying you're a compulsive overeater. So, you know, I think they all three coincide.
Go ahead. Sure, Rebecca.
I just wanted to say, too, from my personal experience, too, you know, there are people who can compulsively overeat but who aren't a food addict. For me, as a food addict, that was all I thought about. I couldn't stop myself when I started. It wasn't like I it's a holiday, I'm overeating. It was all day, every day. It consumed my thoughts. It was everything I did. You know, I'm almost 30 years old, and I was 288 pounds when I started my journey, and, you know, lost 140 pounds. And the biggest thing for me, you know, you talked about, are people aware that they're a food addict? I was in complete denial. I didn't know how I had gotten up to 288 pounds. Clearly, I was watching what I was eating, but I couldn't understand it. For being a smart person, how could this have escaped me? Hmm. You know, and I don't think it's talked about. I found a brochure in my doctor's office and went to my first meeting. It's not something that's very publicized because it's a very secret disease, and I don't think it's easy to identify in our loved ones. We don't understand it like we do, you know, alcoholism or drug addiction.
If a young woman is 288 pounds, I don't know how tall you are, but if a young woman is 288 pounds or more, why isn't that easily identifiable among family members? Why didn't they notice? Why didn't they know something was wrong? Why didn't they notice when you ate?
Because
you were eating a lot more than everybody else.
But I wasn't. I was secret. I would make my plate look like yours did while we were together, and on the way home I would treat myself and reward myself for looking like I was doing everything normal. Or I offered to cook the baked goods for our holiday events, and I would cut my family members small pieces because I knew if I brought it I could take it back home. I would offer to help clean up the kitchen while everybody else sat at the table so that I could nibble on the leftovers while nobody else saw. That's the kind of addiction that I had.
We'll talk about why what others told you as to why and what you think the reason was why you had this compulsion in a second or two. One definition that I read said that food addiction manifests itself in the uncontrollable craving for excess food that follows the ingestion of refined carbohydrates, primarily sugar and flour substances, that are quickly metabolized and turned into sugar in the bloodstream. We have a doctor here, and we have a clinical dietitian. Would you agree with that definition? Let me begin with you, Ellen.
Well, I think, this, based on research and scientific evidence, that, yes, refined flour and sugar can cause you to want to eat more, but a lot of times, I would say, not necessarily a normal person, but is able to stop eating it. But a person who has a food addiction is unable to stop that.
Doctor?
No, and I would agree with the definition about, you know, there are certain kinds of foods that people are more prone to eat compulsively. And I mean, I'm sure you can talk to your guests, but you know, I always say to my patients, no one comes in and says, I had a really horrible night last night. I just binged on broccoli all night. You know, that's not doing it. You know, it'd be great. It'd be great if that was our go-to food.
Why is that? Why is that?
I actually do have a patient that binges on broccoli.
Do you really?
I do.
Oh, that might be a whole other issue then. But you know, that is definitely not the norm. And
she does because she puts ketchup on it and wants the ketchup.
There you go.
Is it harmful? Does it lead to obesity or health problems, binging on broccoli?
I think she has more gastrointestinal issues than...
I would think so. But to get back to your other question about why is that, it really gets back to then sort of the neurobiology of just addiction. And, you know, one thing I really want to make clear is, again, as your other guest said, not everybody who has a weight problem is a food addict, and not everybody who has a weight problem is unhappy with their weight. And really, you know, unless it's impacting somebody's quality of life or impacting their health, you know, I think it's really personal choice but as to what you want to weigh. But once it's that people become unhappy with their weight, then it becomes an issue that society needs to get better at addressing. And when I talk to a lot of my patients, we use some screening tools for food addiction, and we ask some of them, and these are people who have weight difficulties and they're trying to lose weight usually. You know, some of them look at the questionnaires on food addiction and go, I don't do any of this. This is crazy. Because they simply don't. They don't have food addiction. And while others will sort of look at them and just look at you often with tears in their eyes going, you know, thank God somebody finally gets it. And so it really is person dependent. Hmm. But if you want to talk about, you know, why chocolate, why sugars, all of the things that are really available by the droves right now. In terms of addiction, the chemical that's related to addiction is called dopamine. And so dopamine increases in your brain when you take cocaine, when you take heroin, all of those kinds of things. And dopamine's related to pleasure-seeking behavior. Dopamine is increased when you eat as well, for everybody, because your body wants you to continue to do things we need to survive, and we need to eat to survive. Some people seem to have higher levels of dopamine released when they eat specific foods, and those kinds of foods are things like sweet foods and complex carbohydrates. They're going to get into your system faster. They're going to release more dopamine. People are going to have a really pleasurable reaction to eating, and then they're going to crash when the food goes away. And so you just get into this addictive pattern where they're looking for a rush all over again. And you know, these people really struggle with diet,
so
because they're losing it.
One of the sources that I read said for some people, sugar and flour unleash a hunger that is never fully sated, and that's what's happening with these people who become addicted to food, to these certain foods. They have to have more because when they don't get it, they crash and they feel miserable.
There's been some work done with animals where they sort of raise animals on, you know, a typical unhealthy North American diet where they're eating things like bacon and cheese and cheesecake and all of these foods. And when they take that away from the animals and give them sort of healthier choices, if they've been used to getting these other foods, they'll actually start to starve themselves, even though there's, you know, healthy food available.
We have to take a break. We're coming right back with more Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Carolina Medical Lab, a comprehensive medical laboratory serving patients and physicians in North and South Carolina since 1998. Further information and details available at cmedlab.com. On Tuesday, we take this program to Durham in a cooperative effort with WUNC, and it's the second in a series of programs looking at the New South. We did this a couple of months ago from our studios with Frank Stacio, the host of The State of Things at WUNC, and on Monday at 9 o'clock. We will replay that program in advance of our second look at things in the New South. We'll take a look again at the business, economics, and politics of our region and how it has been evolving. We're moving beyond banking while the Triangle's also adopting new industries, replacing textiles and tobacco and warehousing. That broadcast on Monday, and then on Tuesday we'll talk about arts and other things in the New South from WUNC in Durham.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the Friday News Roundup, the House votes to repeal the health care overhaul law, China's president visits the White House, and the legacy of Sergeant Shriver.
That's the news roundup on the Diane Rehm Show this morning at 10, here on listener-funded 90.7 FM, WFAE, your NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about food addiction and compulsion today with Dr. Valerie Taylor, who's a psychiatrist in the Mood Disorders Program and the director of the Bariatric Psychiatry Program at St. Joseph's Healthcare in Hamilton, Ontario. She joins us by phone. Ellen Carey is with us in our studio. She's a clinical dietitian at the Center for Disordered Eating at Levine Children's Hospital. And Rebecca is with us. She is a recovering food addict and a member of Food Addicts in Recovery Anonymous, which we will also talk about. I had to interrupt a story that you were telling, Doctor, about animals, farm animals, that are being fed a what you described as a normal, unhealthy North American diet. And when they are taken off that diet, they refuse to eat the foods that are good for them. They literally starve themselves. How do you explain that phenomenon?
And so it wasn't farm animals, so it was lab animals.
Okay.
Because this was an experiment that they were doing, just trying to understand some of these phenomenon. And so people were trying to understand the very question you just asked. And again, it seems like the brain gets used to needing this kind of surge in these pleasurable chemicals that are associated with this food, and they're just not getting it from the broccoli. And so when the cheesecake was no longer available, they were just so distraught, and they were going into withdrawal, and they would prefer to not eat anything.
As opposed to the healthy foods.
The healthy food.
Did you find yourself in a similar situation, Rebecca? Where if the things that you like to eat weren't available, would you simply not eat?
Absolutely not. I found something. I would search high and low. I would concoct things that, of course, edible things, but I would eat anything. It didn't matter. I didn't have a favorite. It was my drug.
Was this only around mealtimes?
No.
Or was this all the time?
All the time. What's funny is you talk about, sugar and flour and then having that crash. For me, I talked about, it's my blood sugar. I need my 10 o'clock snack. Or, I'm starting to feel, tired. I need that pick-me-up. So for me, I always turned to food. And usually it was flour and sugar. But I can tell you, I would not be afraid to binge on broccoli. I would probably smother it with some kind of dressing or something, but I have a problem with quantities as well. It's not just those two types of foods.
This is radio, so it's difficult for people to judge what people look like by the sound of their voice. You weighed at 28, 288 pounds. I don't know what you weigh right now, but you would be described by any person who saw you as thin, fit right now. When did this food addiction start for you? When did you first begin to engage in this activity?
Well, what was interesting is in high school, I was always fairly thin. I'm about 6 feet tall. I was probably about 140 pounds in high school. And it's very interesting as a woman to now actually say your weight, because I'm no longer ashamed of it. It's part of my story. But when I went to college, I gained all the weight. And I don't know if it was because my metabolism slowed down. I had always, always been drawn to flour and sugar. As a kid in high school, when I would go home, when my parents weren't home, I would eat, fruit just dipped in sugar. And then when the fruit ran out, I would just eat spoonfuls of sugar. So I think it started early on for me. There was no one thing that happened and all of a sudden I turned to food. Mm-hmm. It was kind of gradual. But when I went to college, that's just... I used that to get through life.
She talked about dipping fruit in sugar and eating it, and when the fruit ran out, eating just the sugar. Is that proof of the addictive quality of sugar in chemically in the brain or elsewhere in the body?
I think that is a good example. I would say that would be for a good example for Rebecca, because that's exactly what happened. It was probably... setting a precedent almost for her to become a food addict later in life. Not necessarily does that happen with everybody, no. But that is definitely what happened with her.
And doctor, you talked a second ago about dopamine and the fact that dopamine is released in our body when we eat, and it tells us that we're having an enjoyable experience here. But I also read that overweight and obese people sometimes experience less brain activity in the area of the brain that controls impulsivity than normal weight people would. They have a dimmed reaction to food. So as a result of overeating, your brain needs more food to register the fact that it's being sated?
Well, it's exactly parallel to what happens with cocaine addiction. And so when someone takes cocaine, their dopamine receptors in their brain just go crazy, and the brain loves it. This, you know, feels great despite the fact that it causes lots of problems later. But what happens is that you basically burn out your dopamine receptors because you're using them so much that they get worn down. And so then you have to take increasing amounts of a substance in order to get the same kind of effect because you're actually burning them out. So the same thing with food. So in the beginning, you know, a little bit of sugar is going to do it. But after a while, you're going to need more and more of it to get the same kind of response, because your receptors are just fatigued. And that's the hallmark of addiction from a psychiatric perspective, in that it takes more and more of a substance to get the same kind of response. And so you have to increase the amount over time. And so the amount of food that people eat slowly increases over time, and hence they develop weight problems.
So your brain is being technically rewired.
Yeah, it wants this buzz, but you've stimulated it so much that instead of having 10 receptors to stimulate, now you only have 2. And so if you can't increase the receptor activity, you have to increase the stimulating substance instead.
So for those people who are not overweight, they sometimes look at those who are and think, no willpower. If they would just exercise some willpower. It's not that, is it? It's something far deeper than that.
Oh, absolutely. And that's something that we try to get across so much to people. I see patients who've quit smoking, who've quit drug use, who've quit alcohol use. They have more willpower than anybody I know. But the one thing they can't seem to get a handle on is food consumption, despite the fact that they really try. I've seen patients come to my office who've had their jaws wired shut. I don't even know where one goes to get that done, and no one ever should. But they're so desperate, and they simply can't seem to do it without some kind of help. And so they'll start to do very unhealthy and crazy things. And that's not a lack of willpower. If they were able to do it, they would. And the extremes that people go to try to get it under control proves that. There's something else going on for a lot of people.
Rebecca.
I just wanted to say, too, I completely agree with that. I was wanting so bad to have willpower and self-discipline, and I showed that in every other area of my life. I would be in top control, super organized, and this is the one thing I couldn't do, because I was bringing foods into my body that gave me uncontrollable cravings for more of that stuff that was not feeding my body.
And did you notice it building up over time? In other words, you had to start someplace. You were thin in high school, you said. But then as you began to do things like dip fruit in sugar, did you find yourself having to dip more fruit in sugar, dipping pretzels in sugar?
Yes. It was never enough. And this was the one thing that I wanted to get control over, my weight. And it's the one thing I couldn't do anything about. And so I ate over that because I was depressed.
And I suppose what is partly insidious about this is that this, you don't just wake up one morning at 140 pounds and the next morning you're 288 pounds. It happens over a long period of time. But surely you notice it over that period of time. So when you gained the first 20 pounds, the first 30 pounds, why didn't you say, I got to get a handle on this?
You know, I don't know. And I tried a couple different ways. I tried different diet plans. I tried different doctors. If they sold it on an infomercial in the middle of the night when I was awake with indigestion because of what I had eaten, I bought it. I owned it. I tried. I knew I had a weight problem. I thought, I've got to get this under control. And it was really embarrassing, too, to have people see me who hadn't seen me in a while. And watch me putting on this weight, but yet I couldn't figure out why I couldn't stop eating. I knew I had a problem with my weight, but I couldn't stop it. It was uncontrollable.
Ellen Carey.
Well, I think a lot of time when people overeat and can't stop eating, you know, like you said, Mike, that it's a gradual increase. You know, it didn't happen overnight. And I think a lot of times when people realize that they have gained all this weight, they want a quick fix. They, like you said, you went on an info, you know, watch an infomercial and say, oh, that will make me lose weight, you know, 10 pounds in a week. You know, so then you want to do it, and then you drop a couple pounds, and then you just kind of forget about it, and then you gain more back. I mean, 95% of all dieters fail. You know, that is a very high statistic. So, I mean, I think taking the word diet out of everybody's vocabulary is almost a positive thing, because diet's a four-letter word.
And they don't work.
Right. And they don't work.
And when I was successful, I rewarded myself with food, to be honest.
Dr. Taylor.
Well, I mean, I can't say enough bad things about the diet industry. And I think that if no one ever went on a diet, no one would ever have a weight problem. I mean, I think that what happens is, you know, exactly as Rebecca said, it's not lose 20 pounds in, you know, 3 weeks. And then you gain back 25, and then you lose the 25, you gain back 40. You lose the 40, you gain back 60. And these plans are completely, they're taking advantage of a vulnerable, desperate population.
Well, then how should you do it?
Well, I mean, I'm sure that you know, the dietitian on the panel can really speak a lot to this as well, but slowly, gradually, safely.
Right. I think it takes a good support system, too. I mean, yeah. I really think you need, you know, mental health help.
Yeah.
You need a dietitian. You need a medical professional. And you need a good support system. If it's your family, if it's a mentor, if it's somebody that's gone through the same situation, I think it takes a whole family approach.
Mm-hmm.
Family meaning all medical professionals, mental health professionals, and your actual family.
What role did your, if any, did your family play in all this? This began for you in college and afterward, and,
mm-hmm.
and you were 28 at your high weight, so you had moved out of the house, one would presume.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So but what role did they play in all this? Because you mentioned that you were ashamed, that you didn't like to see people that you hadn't seen in a while because they would be shocked by your appearance.
Mm-hmm.
What about your family who saw it gradually over time?
I was very good at hiding my emotions from them, hiding my dissatisfaction about my weight from them. They were supportive. My parents tried to, you know, introduce me to gyms. They were very loving and supportive, but they couldn't do for me what I wasn't willing to do for myself.
Anybody else in your family suffer from the same thing?
I'd rather not discuss that.
Okay. Talk about the impact. The shame is one thing, but talk about what this did to your life. Because I think you also said at some point in your story that you have this when-then
yes.
approach. When I lose the weight, then I will have friends. When I lose the weight, then I'll have a social life. I'll go out and party at night.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about what it did to you.
I was 26 years old when I found, the program. And, you know, my life consisted of a resting heart rate of 160. At home, I had to lay with my feet elevated because my ankles were so swollen. I was in sweats constantly, like body sweating. And just not, I would lie. If a friend invited me to go somewhere, I'd lie and tell him I was doing something else because I didn't want to leave the house. My Friday nights consisted of ordering takeout food, pretending on the phone, hey, what do you want? Nobody was there. It was just me. I just didn't want the delivery guy to know that all of the food he was bringing was for me. And now that's not the case with my life.
Mm-hmm.
My relationships have improved. I've been through more things in this four-year time period, the loss of a job, and I didn't have to eat over it.
Food is expensive.
Yes.
What did that do to your budget?
I have saved so much money. What I spend on groceries in a week equates to what I used to spend just a week on my 3 o'clock snack, because I would go to the buy the pound candy store and buy about $10 worth of candy and bring it back in a black bag so nobody knew what it was and hide it because I certainly didn't want to share it with anybody and I didn't want people to know what I was doing.
Now, your story is remarkable in because of what happened to you, but it's also remarkable in what the end result is. I don't want to sound ridiculous about this, but no one would know that you had this problem to look at you today. Do most people who go through the program at Food Addicts in Recovery Anonymous have the kind of success that you are obviously experiencing?
If they really work this program as, you know, as it's laid out and eat correctly, absolutely. I'm not taking a magic pill. I'm not in the gym at all. Honestly, this is just by weighing and measuring my food and abstaining completely from flour and sugar. This is available to anybody who wants it. That's the tricky part. You have to want it. You have to really, really want it. And I had gotten to my point of desperation. I had cried uncle, waved the white flag. I was done. I was miserable. I wanted more for my life. And somebody was standing at the front of a room one day that said, I've lost this weight and I've kept it off. And that was the most attractive to me because I can lose weight. I can diet like a champ. But I always find the weight, like Valerie was saying, and I gain it back and then some.
These teenagers, these young people that you work with at the Living Children's Hospital, the teen years or adolescent years are a time in life when we're all very concerned about what others think about us. And if you're overweight, I would think that really has a negative impact on your self-image and on your life, correct?
It does. It does. And I'm not trying to correct you. I actually work at Teen Health Connection, which is an affiliate of Living Children's Hospital.
Okay.
So,
all right.
But teenagers are very, very impressionable. You know, they are still in their growing years, definitely their biggest growing years. So it's very different what you want to tell a teenager versus what you want to tell an adult. Because what you tell a teenager is kind of something that they let set in, and then, you know, decide if they really want to do it. And that's something that's going to stay with them for the rest of their life. They also want instant gratification too, just like an adult does a lot of times. So what you tell a teenager, you want to make sure you're sending them the right message because they are growing, they are developing, they are still at that point where they can make decisions that really can make a difference. So telling a teenager that they need to lose weight can also be harmful. You know, you want to make sure you represent a good message, saying that it's more lifestyle changes versus just losing that weight. So, you know, analyzing, you know, what are the environmental factors, what are the behavior factors that they're going through too.
Yeah, it's a myriad of things I would guess that lead to this. Some overeaters say that they eat to try to fill a hole left by something else, sadness, lack of a mate, lack of success in life, whatever it is, low grades, not a weak social network. What's going on psychologically that would make us turn to food to fill that hole, Doctor?
I mean, I think that there's a whole lot of things, both from basic biology to psychology, that explains some of that. When we think about foods like simple or complex carbohydrates, you know, like our muffins, like our bread. When you eat that, it goes into your body. Your body turns it into tryptophan. Tryptophan is turned into serotonin. When people are depressed, often what's going on is that they don't have a lot of serotonin in their brain. And so the antidepressants are designed to increase serotonin. So things like muffins do the exact same thing. So when people say comfort food, they're not kidding. It makes you feel better. You get this burst of serotonin and you feel better.
I want to come back and talk about comfort food in a second or two in that cycle, but first we have to take a break. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Blumenthal Performing Arts, presenting the comedy Celebrity Autobiography in their own words. Superstars' memoirs are acted out on stage in the Booth Playhouse, January 25th through the 30th. Tickets at BlumenthalCenter.org. Coming up at 10 o'clock, it's the Diane Rehm Show, and it's the weekly news roundup, the National Hour, first at 10 o'clock, in which they will talk about the House vote to repeal the health care overhaul law, the Chinese president's visit to the White House, and the legacy of Sergeant Shriver. That's in the first hour, among other topics. And then in the 11 o'clock hour, they'll tackle an overview of the week's international news. If you'd like to join our conversation about food compulsion and addiction, now's the time. 704-926-WFAE at 704-926-9323, 800-603-WFAE, or WFAE.org/Charlotte Talks. We're coming right back.
In a fast-paced world, it's sometimes hard to separate fact from fiction. And that's where NPR's weekday news program, Morning Edition, comes in. We'll help you fend off information overload by bringing you the news that matters most. I'm Renee Montaigne. Tune out the fiction and tune in to Morning Edition from NPR News.
In-depth morning news you can trust weekdays on Morning Edition from 5 till 9 on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins, and we're talking to Dr. Valerie Taylor, a psychiatrist at St. Joseph's Healthcare in Hamilton, Ontario, who deals with mood disorders, and she's in she's the director of the bariatric psychiatry program there. Ellen Carey is a clinical dietitian with Teen Health Connection in association with Levine's Children's Hospital and the Center for Disordered Eating. And Rebecca is a recovering food addict and a member of Food Addicts in Recovery Anonymous. Her story is online at WFA Eats. That's our food blog. You go to wfae.org/WFAEats for that and for a quiz to help you find out if you might be a food addict. There are actually 20 things, and I'm going to read them very quickly. To find out if you're a food addict, ask yourself the following questions and then answer them as honestly as you can. 1. Have you ever wanted to stop eating and found that you just couldn't? 2. Do you think about food or your weight constantly? 3. Do you find yourself attempting one diet or food plan after another with no lasting success? 4. Do you binge and then get rid of the binge through vomiting, exercise, laxatives, or other forms of purging? 5. Do you eat differently in private than you do in front of other people? 6. Has a doctor or family member ever approached you with concern about your eating habits or your weight? 7. Do you eat large quantities of food at one time? 8. Is your weight problem due to your nibbling all day long? 9. Do you eat to escape from your feelings? 10. Do you eat when you're not hungry? 11. Have you ever discarded food only to retrieve it and eat it later? 12. Do you eat in secret? 13. Do you fast or severely restrict your food intake? 14. Have you ever stolen other people's food? 15. Have you ever hidden food to make sure you have enough? 16. Do you feel driven to exercise excessively or control your weight? 17. Do you obsessively calculate the calories that you've burned against the calories you've eaten? 18. Do you frequently feel guilty or ashamed about what you've eaten? 19. Are you waiting for your life to begin when you lose the weight? And 20. Do you feel hopeless about your relationship with food? And I went through all 20 of them because if you answered yes to any of those questions, then you may be a food addict. That's pretty scary stuff. Let's go back to comfort food here for a second. Because we've all heard the term comfort food, and, you know, Thanksgiving is comfort food to me. When you think about the turkey and the dressing and all the stuff that goes along. We've all seen characters in movies and TV shows who may be depressed. And they get through that by getting in bed with a carton of ice cream and just eating away at that carton of ice cream. What is it about food that makes us associate it with an anesthetic to numb the pain of whatever it is we're going through?
To me personally, it was because it was an immediate hit. I could get it. I could get what I wanted, whatever I was in the mood for. I had a food. I had a restaurant for if somebody was nice to me, if it was raining. I had something. It was something I could get immediate. Other people didn't need to know about it. And it was easily accessible.
And what comes first, Doctor, the depression that causes you to use food as an anesthetic, or the fact that you become increasingly overweight, which makes you depressed, which makes you use more food, which makes you become more overweight, which makes you, it's a vicious cycle. How does it start?
You know, and that's a very, very good question, and that's one of the things that I'm doing research on, and lots of people all over the world are doing research on, because we know that two things are very, very linked, and we need to know, you know, what does come first. Chicken or the egg, you know, is it weight problems and then depression, is it depression and then weight problems, because they share a lot of commonalities. I think it's different based on gender, for one thing. Now, we know that young girls, if they have weight problems in sort of early life, early adolescence, they're much more likely to go on then and develop problems with self-esteem and then depression. There's, you know, in society, there's more roles for the bigger guys in school. They can be on the hockey team. They can be on the football team. There's more socially accepted places for them to kind of find some kind of niche for themselves. It's much harder, not impossible, but much harder for young girls. And so if they have weight difficulties, they really often feel isolated. And so for that group, it seems like weight comes first. You know, for other people, depression starts because depression's an illness that happens regardless of whether you're big or small. Once that happens for some people, unfortunately, the medications that are necessary for the treatment of some mental illnesses can cause weight problems, especially if that's not being recognized and managed by physicians prescribing them. And then that leads to a vicious cycle. So there's a whole bunch of things. And then depression that's not treated is often medicated with food because, as we said before, food releases the same kind of chemicals immediately that you get with antidepressants. And our comfort foods make us happy. You just crash, much as with the dopamine analogy, and you go looking for more food to make you happy again.
In Rebecca's story, she wrote that she learned that she didn't have a weight problem. She had an eating problem, an addiction to food. Is that a good rule of thumb, that people who are overweight, they don't have a weight problem? Is that they have a food disorder? Is that what the problem is?
I would definitely agree with that. You know, weight is just a number, and it's a result of our behaviors. So, you know, it's more so focusing on what those behaviors are than versus how much you weigh.
Doctor?
And I would completely agree as well. And that's why, you know, diets don't work. As Rebecca said, she was a champ at losing weight. It's really easy to lose weight. I can make anybody lose weight. It's not hard at all. The trick is keeping it off. And the keeping it off and not putting it back on is because there's things much more complicated than just weight happening. And you need to address those other things that impact.
You are a doctor, you are a psychiatrist, and the director of the bariatric psychiatry program at St. Joseph's Healthcare in Hamilton, Ontario. How many of your patients are able to change their behavior versus have bariatric surgery or some other procedure?
You know, it depends on the person, and it depends on the amount of weight they have to lose. If somebody comes in to see us and they weigh 400 pounds, they don't have the time often to make some of the lifestyle changes because they're going to die before that happens. So for that, you know, that group of people, it's a life-saving operation, and they have to have it. Now, it doesn't mean that you have surgery and it's magic. The changing behaviors have to occur after surgery because surgery is not 100% cure-all. And people, we've seen, unfortunately, what happens when people just go, call it medical tourism, and they go to places and just have surgery in Mexico or wherever and come back, and they haven't had any of the other factors addressed. They will gain weight back again, and they will have problems. And so the behavioral changes have to be put in place irregardless of the approach. But for people who have less weight to lose, the first thing we try to do is get them to stop dieting, because we know that that's a huge problem. And then we work on the kinds of issues that seem to be contributing. So it's figuring out, you know, with them, because we're not going to tell them, they're going to tell us, because it's so different for everybody. But it's to figure out sort of what's their triggers, what's kind of got them there, and then work with them as they develop strategies to get around it.
Let's take a couple of phone calls here before we run out of time, and we'll begin in Mooresville. Maggie, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you for taking the call. I'm concerned, well, I'll start this off by saying, I myself could probably stand and knock off a couple of pounds. However, you know, I worry about my husband deeply, and I'm wondering what advice you would have for me and for others to help a family member. I bring this up about anything to do with lifestyle, eating, any of it, and he gets really offended. I personally don't want to be the food police, and even if I quote something nutritious, you know, he'll just go get more or go get something else. He'll knock back couple of Pepsis in any given meal.
Wow.
Sour cream, potatoes, bread.
So how do you help family? How do you help family members and not be brushed off?
Well, this is Rebecca. For me, my family could not have done it for me. If they would have pushed something in my lap, I would have resented it. I had to come to terms, and I'm just speaking from personal experience, I had to come to terms with the fact that I wanted to do something about it. As much as I'm sure my family wanted to help me and wanted to practically drive me to Weight Watchers meetings or something, I had to want it for myself.
How did you get involved in Food Addicts in Recovery?
I found a pamphlet in my doctor's office when I was trying to fan myself because I was hot. I looked down, saw that it said, "Do you have trouble controlling the way that you eat?" And I said, "Yes." You know, you could point him.
Is it like AA when you go to the? How often do you go to meetings? Every week? Every day?
I go to 3 meetings a week.
And is it like AA?
Absolutely. It's a 12-step program.
How does it help? How did it work for you?
Well,
what was it about that program that allowed you to lose this remarkable amount of weight?
Because the FA program for me helped me explore in a soft and gentle way why I ate. It didn't just deal with the symptom and try to get that number on the scale to go down. It dealt with my disease. And that's what I believe I have, a disease, an allergy to flour and sugar, like other people have allergy to peanuts. But I break out in fat and crazy.
Mm-hmm.
So.
And going to meetings 3 times a week keeps it in check. You have a sponsor?
I do. I have a sponsor.
And as I understand it, the sponsor in this organization helps the people or the person that they're sponsoring by tailoring what, your behavioral program, your eating program?
They just basically, you know, if anybody has been in program for 6 months and has been abstinent, that's our definition of abstaining from flour and sugar and watching our quantities, just like an alcoholic would be sober. Mm-hmm. You can then turn around and give what you've received to somebody else. So, yes, you know, calling a sponsor, walking through a food plan, going to meetings, because that's where I can connect with other people and I'm not so unique, because food addiction is a disease of isolation.
Is there really any difference, doctor, from a psychiatric point of view, of a food addiction to a cocaine addiction to an alcohol addiction? Is it the same principle at work, essentially?
The same principles really are sort of underlying what's happening, and so we take a lot of our sort of direction in terms of treatment from programs that have been around for a long time, like Alcoholics Anonymous and hence you get Overeaters Anonymous. And one of the basic tenets of, you know, getting somebody into a substance addiction program is that, you know, most places work on self-referral. I can't refer somebody there because it's pointless for me to tell them that they need to get this under control. Mm-hmm. They need to decide.
What's the difference between Overeaters Anonymous and Food Addicts in Recovery Anonymous? What's the difference? Do you know?
The one thing that I can say is I believe the definition of abstinence of what makes in Food Addicts and Recovery Anonymous, mm-hmm. the definition of abstinence is much more defined, I believe, is the one big thing. And I believe Overeaters Anonymous focuses more on the compulsive overeating, mm-hmm. while Food Addicts views it more as an addiction. And so we try to hit at that.
Let me go to Hickory.
They're
Bill.
They're both pretty similar.
I'm sorry, Dr. Taylor, I interrupted you. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, I think they're both pretty similar. It's just around semantics and approaches,
okay.
But they share common principles.
Let's go to Hickory. Bill, you're on WFAE.
Yes, I consider myself a stress eater, and I sometimes joke that people that smoke or drink or do illegal drugs can quit and never touch another one again, but you can't really stop eating. And then once you start eating, then you have to face with stopping. It's not like you can just stop and never touch another piece of food. I just wonder how folks deal with that.
Go ahead.
And I can tell you some of the things that my patients do, and you're absolutely right. And Rebecca can tell you a little bit about some of the different treatment programs do abstinence, in which you can't obviously, as you say, avoid food, but they will avoid sort of certain foods that really are linked to problematic eating patterns, like some of the complex sugars, carbohydrates, those kinds of things. And after that, it's just, you know, we get people to do things like really listening to their bodies and eating around the clock. Mm-hmm. And so you eat at kind of 9, 10:30, noon, 3 o'clock, 5 o'clock. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't matter kind of what else is going on, where you are, what smells good. You only eat at those specific times.
And we talked a little bit about why people continue to overeat, and we're running short on time, so I'm going to summarize a couple of phone call questions here, because you talked about how dopamine receptors become they don't transmit the information anymore, and that's why you keep eating. Is there a way to improve that over time? Can you reverse that?
Absolutely. And so there will be, if you stop the behavior, you know, your brain is a bit plastic in some ways, and that you can reverse some of this stuff. And so we know that from in cocaine addicts, that if they become abstinent, that some of the changes are reversible. So same thing with food. And so absolutely.
Okay. You mentioned that your resting heart rate at your top weight of 288 was 160. And another caller wants to know what it is now.
Well, I was on medicine to bring it down, and it got down to 40-something, and I went back to my cardiologist, and he said, you no longer need to be on this medicine anymore. So now, yesterday I was at the doctor, and I think it was in the mid-50s.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Oh, my gosh. It's far better than mine. Mm-hmm. a couple of questions that came in on email. As a food addict who is in recovery with another 12-step program, it concerns me that Mike keeps referring to Rebecca's thinness and focuses on the weight portion of the addiction. Please address the emotional and spiritual illnesses at play. And we kind of have over time, right?
Mm-hmm.
Were there emotional and spiritual? Is there a spiritual component to this?
Absolutely. Because I could never do this on my own. I have to turn to a higher power. That's something, whatever you choose to believe, something outside me, because I didn't have the willpower and the self-discipline, so I needed something to help me. And the emotional, absolutely.
I also want to stress that not all food addicts or food disorders deal with people gaining weight. Some of them deal with people losing horrible amounts of weight, bulimia, anorexia, etc. And you see people like that too, correct?
Yes.
And help them. Is that, what's working there? We only have 15 seconds. What's it work there? Something completely different than what we've been talking about?
Well, again, it's the family support. It's, mm-hmm. Seeing a dietitian, a medical professional, and getting psychological.
Is this a lifelong struggle?
Yes. For me, absolutely.
Would you agree with that, Doctor?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's certainly, if you can make some lifestyle behaviors and get them to stick, it becomes much, much easier. But definitely people struggle with this.
Dr. Valerie Taylor with St. Joseph's Healthcare in Hamilton, thank you very much for joining us. Hamilton, Ontario. Ellen Carey with the Teen Health Connection here. And Rebecca, recovering food addict. Thank you all for the hour.